You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. I am Martin Indyk, the director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. We are greatly honored today to have the opportunity to host Dr. Ahmet Davutoğlu, the Foreign Minister of Turkey, for a statesman's forum here this evening under the auspices of the Center for the United States and Europe. I think that the Foreign Minister is very well known to all of you. In fact, he has established a reputation around the world now as a global thinker, number seven with a bullet, as we say, on the foreign policy list of 100, the leading thinkers in foreign policy. Just the most recent example of the kind of swathe that he is cutting on the world stage for Turkey as it emerges as a power with influence both in its region and beyond its region. So we're very honored to have you here this evening to address us. Dr. Davutoğlu has a distinguished academic career at a variety of Turkish universities. He worked most recently at Beykent University in Istanbul before becoming, after the November 2002 elections, chief advisor to Prime Minister Erdogan and ambassador at large for the government of the Republic of Turkey. On May 1st, 2009, he was appointed as Minister of Foreign Affairs to the 60th government of the Republic of Turkey. After Dr. Davutoğlu speaks to you this evening, he will join in a conversation with Ömer Taspinar. Ömer is a senior fellow in the Center for US and Europe, focusing on Turkish affairs, and a professor of national security strategy at the U.S. National War College and director of our Turkey project here at the Center for the U.S. and Europe. So, Mr. Minister, thank you very much for joining us, and the podium is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Martin, for this excellent introduction. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor for me to be here at Brookings Institute. Again, it became like a tradition. I gave several speeches. I had chance to attend many meetings in this very esteemed institution, and it's always a great pleasure, and whenever I meet with the esteemed audience in this institution, I always learn something new. I hope today I will have this chance again. The topic is Turkish foreign policy, but I will not focus on foreign policy only, because let me start with a methodological critique. When we speak on foreign policy, usually we may do two methodological mistakes. One is, if we only concentrate on foreign policy, ignoring other elements like domestic politics, like economics, like cultural development, you may not understand what is going on in foreign policy. So you cannot isolate foreign policy from the general transformation of a society. This is about the content of foreign policy. Therefore, I will try to present Turkish foreign policy within such a context of transformation, rather than just focusing on certain detailed individual cases and issues. Secondly, if this is about the substance, about the time framework, if you just concentrate only 1 year, one incident, 1 month, or even 1 decade, and try to understand the transformation of a foreign policy paradigm, you may do another mistake. Unfortunately, today, when I read some of the articles published in Washington, in Brussels, or sometimes even in the Middle East, about Turkish foreign policy, I realized these two methodological mistakes. For example, some I say, the foreign policy paradigm of the pro-Islamic AK Party government, even itself, gives an impression that it is just a foreign policy choice of one group based on some ideology, or a foreign policy based on neo-Ottomanism. For those who do not know anything on Ottoman history, they may think that Turkey is trying to revive Ottoman state, and this literature now emerging does not reflect the picture. In my book, when I wrote Strategic Debt, in the introduction, I made a methodological analysis, and I said the most dangerous methodological mistake of foreign policy analysis is picture analysis. You have a picture in your mind, and you develop a theory based on your picture in your mind, just one picture. While the correct methodological approach in foreign policy analysis is process analysis, not picture analysis. If you want to have a healthy or a comprehensive analysis, you need to have several pictures in your mind, several. It will be as comprehensive as possible if you have many pictures from different time frame in your mind, and try to understand the process, how this foreign policy has been transformed. And Turkish nation has an old history, but I will not go back to 1,000 years ago. I will make an analysis of 200 years of Turkish transformation of modernization, and I promise to do this in half an hour, not more than that, so you can see my difficulty. I can say what we are having today is a restoration. This concept is important, restoration, not paradigm shift, not revolution, but a restoration of Turkish society, economics, politics, and foreign policy. And I can mention three important restorations in the past, and this is the fourth restoration in our modern history. The first, and I will make some analogies with the American restoration in my presentation as well. The first big restoration, as a response to the challenges of industrial revolution and colonialism, which are two bones, backbones of the rise of European hegemony, European order, the first restoration occurred at the beginning of the 19th century in Ottoman society, which was Tanzimat, which was called Tanzimat. It was such a restoration that Turkish politics has been reformed. And many people do not know, and they may think that Turkish democracy, at least not multi-party democracy, but participation, politics, elections, is something, a new phenomenon in Turkey. In Turkey, elections in local administration goes back to the early decades of 19th century, 1820s, 30s, we started to have elections in local administration. And there was a constitutional monarchy, and the first Turkish constitution was adopted in 1876. And the transformation of the society was, especially political transformation, was to include non-Muslim population of Ottoman state to the system as citizens, not in the modern sense, but equal to Muslims. Therefore, we had several reforms. And the foreign policy orientation was Europeanization of Turkish foreign policy as a reflection to the balance of power in Europe. The purpose of this restoration was, after the Congress of Vienna, we became part of the European system. The purpose of this restoration was to defend Ottoman state and to prevent the decline of Ottoman state. This is purely an academic approach. I don't want to give an impression, don't get an impression that I am talking on neo-Ottomanism and trying to revive this. But this is the background. And the first time we had a multi-party election in 1912. real multi-party election, not in 1950s, 1912, 1911. We had many parties, political parties, throughout the Ottoman territories, not only in Anatolia and Istanbul, but in Balkans, in Iraq, or in Lebanon. The second big restoration was the establishment of Turkish Republic. It was parallel to the developments in Europe, the end of the traditional imperial structures in Europe, and Turkey, after the War of Liberation, First World War and War of Liberation, we had another restoration. A new system did emerge, Republic of Turkey, republicanism, and a new concept of citizen emerged. Because of the migrations from Balkans, from Caucasia, from Middle East, from Yemen, a new nation even emerged. And this concept of nation comprised not only ethnically Turkish people, but Bosniaks from Albanians, Bosniaks from Balkans, Chechens, Abkhazians, Georgians, Azeris from Caucasia, Kurds, some Arabs from the Middle East. This second restoration had its own economic dimension, national economy. This is the second restoration. The third restoration was after the Second World War. The international environment has changed, and Turkey responded with a new restoration, multi-party democracy, free market economy, and membership to NATO. What we can call is security-oriented democratization in Turkey. The first incentive was security, because there was a threat from Soviet Union, and we tried to protect the territorial integrity of Turkey. And Turkey became a member of NATO, had a strong strategic alliance with the United States and other members of Europe, and we had a huge transformation of economics from the villages to the cities, a new democratic wave. There was economic, political transformation, and our the new North Atlantic, transatlantic alliance, which emerged, we became part of it. The fourth restoration was needed after the collapse of the Cold War. In fact, what we had today was supposed to be done in 1990s. An economic reformation was needed in 1990s. And a political democratization was needed. And a new foreign policy orientation was needed. We were not able to do it because of basically coalition governments, political instability, economic crisis. Mr. Dervish knows it very well by his own practice, and terrorist activities. Now, just keep this in mind, and I will make a short comparison with the American Restoration. Turkish Restoration in 19th century was parallel to the American Restoration after the Civil War, the consolidation of the United States. Turkish Restoration during the Republican era was parallel to the Wilsonian principles and the emergence of the United States as a new global power, but not bipolar yet. But the Wilsonian principles, which was declared parallel to the establishment of Turkish Republic, before Turkish Republic, was in fact the emergence of the new American consolidation, restoration, Mahan strategy, geopolitical strategy, and all these. When you look at it, America, United States started to become not a continental power, but a player in the global scene. And Turkish Third Restoration was parallel to the formation of the bipolar international structure, and United States was the leader of one pole. Therefore, these restorations were parallel to each other. And in fact, after end of Cold War, both United States and us, we needed a new restoration. And therefore, we are still in this process. United States as a global power, of course, that redefinition of the foreign policy during Clinton administration, afterwards 9/11 and many other, still this search is continuing. But in our sense, we are living in a in the center of Afro-Eurasia, and we need to have a new restoration. What did we try to do in 8 years with this process analysis during AK Party governments? First, we wanted to consolidate our democracy. As this time, not security-oriented democracy, but freedom-oriented democracy. After every military intervention during the Cold War, the new military regime always was saying, we are loyal to NATO and we will restore democracy. These two things were together. This time, of course, we are strong member of NATO, but we want our democracy, freedom-oriented democracy. Therefore, we have reference to European Union, parallel to NATO, because European Union reforms are the only guarantees to have more democracy, more freedom, more liberty, more open society. The second aspect of this restoration is economic development. In the last 8 years, Turkey had an economic change. In 2001, when we had economic crisis, Turkish economy became 26th economy, biggest economy in the world in 2002. And now Turkey is 16th biggest economy. In 8 years, we passed 10 countries, and today we are 16th. After the economic crisis, we are sorry that some of our friendly countries have faced problems, but Turkish economy showed the strength, starting with Mr. Dervish reforms. Then our government took over and continued these reforms in a very strong political way, political power. And therefore, today we have a strong financial system, a dynamic economy, a rising entrepreneurship. There is an economy. Without economic restoration, political restoration cannot be successful. These two restorations, like two legs of a strategic restoration. Strategic restoration is our foreign policy orientation. Nobody should link our foreign policy to any other reason, but we need to have a restoration in domestic, regional, and global environment. Because we are paying the bill if there is any instability or chaos in our surrounding regions. Now, if this is the framework, how can we connect these political and economic restoration with a new foreign policy paradigm? That was the challenge. And we formulated a new foreign policy, yes. But this new foreign policy is neither turning face to East. We don't mind to have this. I'm not trying to be apologetic here. Of course, we will have Eastern background. Or not shift, paradigm shift, but what we want is what we need for political economic consolidation, which type of foreign policy orientation we need. For example, we declared zero problems with our neighbors. When I became chief advisor, in my first, one of the first interviews, I declared this policy. I remember those days. Many observers, analysts, they made joke from my, regarding my background. They said, typical utopic academician, poetic language, zero problems with neighbors, but cannot be translated into a foreign policy, realistic foreign policy. Why did we declare this? Why did I declare? I know, knowing human history, even knowing family history, brothers and sisters, they may have problems. Knowing human history, of course, there are problems between neighbors. But what I try to do is to make a transformation of mentality. Because throughout the Cold War, the basic teaching we learned in our schools were Turkey has three sides, seas, four side enemies. All nations around us were taught to us as enemy. Russians, because we had so many wars in the past. Greece, they are arch enemy. Bulgarians, enemy. Arabs, of course, ideological enemy. Iran, historical rival. As if you are living in a neighborhood and you are being isolated. Now, we had to make a transformation. They are saying, some people are saying, this is an indication that Turkey, this government, being given a suspicious, emotion, wants to develop, once it was told to me, you are very clever. You are hiding your agenda, secret agenda, through this type of terminology, zero problems with our neighbors. In fact, you want to develop your relations with Iran and Syria, the axis of evil. And in order to cover this, you are using this terminology. This question was asked, I said, do you know Turkish geography? Anybody who knows Turkish geography knows very well we have 4 Muslim neighbors and 8 non-Muslim neighbors, including Black Sea. And in the last 8 years, our relation with Georgia, a Christian neighbor, developed much more than our relation with Iran. Or our relation with Greece has developed as our relation with Syria. Our relation with Russia has developed like our relation with Iraq. And today, I don't want to give details. If there are questions, I can give. Only just one example. Turkey and Greece, in 87 years of our relations, signed only 35 agreements until last May. Last May, in one day, we signed 23 agreements. In one day. And if it is no Ottoman policy, first Greek friends would rebel because they didn't accept this. They wouldn't accept this. Or if it is pro-Islamic, then Orthodox Serbs would not accept it, but today we have excellent relations with Serbia. Yes, we abolished visa with Syria, with Azerbaijan, we are trying, with Libya, with Lebanon, but we abolished visa with Serbia as well, with Russia. So why do we need this? Because we need a restoration, consolidation of peace and stability around us. Say, yes, about regional politics, let us continue. Why Turkey is proactive, very ambitious foreign policy you are following, and they are even saying, can you continue this policy with this dynamism? I am saying this is a necessity. It is not a matter of choice. But we are living in a neighborhood that every day we have to take care of all events around us. In Balkans, in Middle East, in Caucasia, in Central Asia, we need to have political order. We need to have stability. Because, therefore I mentioned Republican restoration, because of the First World War, although we left Balkans, Balkans has been Anatolized, let me say this, a new concept, Anatolized, because many Balkan nations migrated to Anatolia. Although we left Caucasia, Caucasia became Anatolized because Caucasian peoples migrated to Turkey. Whatever happens in Caucasia is our domestic issue. Therefore, I know WikiLeaks, in these days, I was asked just now in Washington Post about my speech in Sarajevo last year. It was called as a very indication that we are following Ottoman, neo-Ottoman policy. Yes, I made a speech. There I said, Bosnian issue is like our domestic issue. Why did I say this? Why? Because there are more Bosnians living in Bosnia than in Turkey than in Bosnia. There are more Bosniaks living in Turkey than in Bosnia. There are more Albanians living in Turkey than in Albania. And if something happens in Sarajevo, we cannot say it is far away. Next day, there will be a big demonstration in Istanbul asking our government to help Bosniak brothers and sisters. If there was, last year there was an unrest in Sinchian, in Urumqi, far away, and it was not part of Ottoman territory anyway, but 300,000 Uyghurs living in Turkey, there were demonstrations in Ankara and Istanbul and in other cities and asking government to help. And we have very good relations with China. How can you do this? What do we want? Nothing more, nothing less. Equal relations with all nations around us and political stability and security around us. In, therefore, we have to have an assertive. Therefore, we said from the first day, we said proactive peace diplomacy. Proactive peace diplomacy is needed in order to prevent crisis. Therefore, we are active in Iraq. Because if Iraq is divided, if Iraq is in chaos, Turkey will pay the price. Therefore, before coming here, a few days ago, we were in Lebanon. And our prime minister met with all the leaders of Lebanese politics just to control the crisis there. We don't have any national interest there. And I told once to one Bosnian Serb politician, I said, if you may criticize our, but we don't have any national interest in Bosnia. Bosnia doesn't have natural gas. We are not here to bring here to exploit. But what we need is just political stability. Do not repeat the same mistakes of 1990s. Then we will have. We have now excellent relations with Serbia, and we have trilateral mechanisms, Serbia, Bosnia, Turkey, Turkey, Bosnia, Croatia. Therefore, we were very active in order to restart, in order to have indirect talks between Syria and Israel. Therefore, we are vocal in regarding Palestine, because without solving Palestinian question, there cannot be political stability in the Middle East. There cannot be democratization in the Middle East as well, because of that political that crisis, all Middle Eastern societies are in a psychology of extraordinary situation. When my book was realized, was translated into Arabic a few months ago, Strategic Depth, in the launching, they asked me to give a speech. I gave a speech and I said, the question was, what is the purpose of the book? I said, the purpose of the book is normalization of history. Just, this is the simple formula of our foreign policy. Normalization of history. Because Cold War was abnormality. Abnormality. Because of Cold War statical polarization, we became isolated from Syria. Our border with Syria is not natural. Our border with Georgia is not natural. Our border with Iraq is not natural. What we want to do without changing the borders, with full respect to the borders, we want to have full integration with all the neighbors, with all the surrounding regions. What is the economic reflection of this policy? The economic reflection is clear. Let me say, just imagine a map in your mind and put in Europe, Germany, France, Italy. In the North, Russia. In the East, China and Japan and India. In the rest of all Afro-Eurasia, the biggest economy is Turkish economy. The most dynamic economy is Turkish economy. We don't want to have sanctions, isolations, trade barriers, visa barriers in this region. We want our economy to be integrated with all. Last year, one of my colleagues from Europe, minister, asked me a question. You can imagine even that is becoming an issue. He said, we are in international economic crisis, and we are thinking to close our embassies in Africa in order to make some saving. And when we are doing this, you are opening 18 embassies in Africa in 1 year. 18, yes. In 8 years, we opened 12 embassies in Africa. In last 2 years, in 1.5 year, we opened, and we will complete in next 6 months, 18 embassies. He said, why? The question is, what Turks want to do in Africa? Turks want to do something very simple. Because in Africa, in Cameroon, for example, Turkish biscuit industries, entrepreneurs are working there. And they are demanding us that they want to have an embassy in order to do their business. This is economic relation. One more thing we want to do, that Africa is our continent. We are not far away from Africa. And this is the global dimension of our foreign policy. Today there is a transformation in global politics, global economy, global culture, and we don't want to have global divide between East and West in cultural sense, between North and South in economic sense. and between transatlantic and others in geopolitical sense. Because in all these divides, Turkey is in the middle, and we are suffering. After 9/11, if there is a tension, with cultural tension, global cultural tension, like clash of civilizations between East and West, Turkey will be affected negatively. We will have to make a choice. We don't want to. We have a choice that we want to integrate with all the environment. If there is a clash between North and South, Turkish economy will be affected. We want to defend the rights, economic rights of African people. Therefore, next year, in May, we will be hosting the least developed countries summit in Turkey. Around 6,000 people will come to Istanbul. We are a member of OECD, yes. We are from the North, yes. But at the same time, we are from the South because of our historical links, because of our big demography, huge demography, and because of our economic characters. And as a global power, we are a member of NATO, yes. We are a member of Transatlantic Alliance, yes. But we don't want NATO to have any confrontation with other nations or group of nations or other regions. Therefore, we were very careful in NATO summit not to declare an enemy front. Because we suffered enough during Cold War because of this polarization. We don't want a new geopolitical polarization in our world. So this restoration, what we need, economic, political, strategic restoration, needs a foreign policy formulation based on regional and global peace. And Turkey is a force of peace. We will not be party or side of any conflict. We will be pioneering of the peace around us, peace at home, as it was declared by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Peace at home, peace in the world. This is the philosophy of our foreign policy. Thank you very much. You sit there. I prefer to stay here. Yeah. Throughout of my life, academic life, I never give lectures when I don't want to give lecture, but when I am sitting, I prefer to have eye contact here. Yes.
Minister, we now know why they refer to you.
But you can sit
you.
If you want.
I'll prefer to sit. We now know why they refer to you as professor all the time, and you have a very lecturing style, and I think you gave us a very rich summary of the Turkey's strategic vision. However, mortals in this city usually think about Turkey in the framework of three major polarizing issues, and they have nothing to do, unfortunately, with the larger strategic vision and the historical depth that you provided us. The image of Turkey in Washington, I think, is being shaped by the divergence that we have currently with the United States on the question of Iran and the nuclear agenda, especially the fact that Turkey voted no in the United Nations Security Council. That, I think, fueled the image of Turkish foreign policy's axis shift, so to speak. The other one is basically Turkey's relations and the deterioration with Israel. So Turkish-Israeli relations also fuel a certain negativity in Turkey's image. And finally, relations with Armenia. So those are the three areas where I would kindly ask if you could say a few words before we open it up to the Q&A.
I didn't mention any of these issues during my presentation because I was sure that this question would come. So I didn't want to waste my time in presentation about this. Let me implement the same methodology which I made in my presentation. If you make a picture analysis, for example, in your question, of course you didn't have this intention, you said no vote in UN Security Council. Mm-hmm. Typical picture analysis. There is a picture, Turkish permanent representative is voting no to sanctions against Iran. What happened before? What happened afterwards? It is not being discussed. This is, again...
That's why we have WikiLeaks.
Yes. No. not you, but this is very... You didn't mean that, of course.
Of course not.
But today I was telling in another meeting, I said, if all the official cables and other documents are being disclosed, we will be very happy. Really, Turkey will be very happy because we followed a foreign policy of principles. We didn't use dual language. We didn't say something in Tehran and different in Washington and other different in New York or in another place. We are ready, this challenge. Open all the archives. Our foreign policy was sincere, principle-oriented, honest, candid. Therefore, we followed. Because of these principles, we wanted to just to contribute to regional and global peace. In all these three issues, let us implement not the picture analysis, but process analysis about Iran. From the very first day we declared the basic principles of Iranian policy, 4 years ago, that Turkey is against any nuclear proliferation, wherever it is, by which country is not important, we are against it. Turkey is against any nuclear power in our region, whichever country has, where we are against it. And Turkey is in favor of nuclear peaceful capacity if that country is partner or party in NPT and IAEA. These are the problems. And Turkey has been, yes, very active. Just to make a picture analysis again, in 2007, the most successful meeting between P5 plus 1 and Iran was held in Ankara. Last year, 1st October, another successful meeting by Jalili and Solana was arranged by us on 12th of September during my visit to Tehran. I called from Tehran, so Mr. Solana, and said 1st of October was fixed. When in the 1st of October meeting, there was a suggestion that there is an exchange proposal of uranium deal, TRR for TRR, the Tehran Research Reactor. This was not our idea. We didn't creatively produce such a policy just to defend Iran. No. It was the idea of Mr. El-Baradei consulting with P5 plus 1. Since there was no mutual trust to each other by both parties, he brought this idea to us that since both parties trust you, can you help us? Therefore, we started that diplomatic process. And until May, we worked very closely with our allies. And there was an agreement. I don't want to go into it. It's a long history. Maybe one day WikiLeaks will make this all public. But we worked in a very close coordination with our allies. And at the end, we had a Tehran declaration. So that's the background of everything. And as I said, to be frank, and we are telling this here, because of this restoration, of economic restoration, we don't want to have sanctions or tensions, military tensions around Turkey. We want stability and security. Because sanctions against Iraq harmed Turkey more than Saddam regime. Therefore, we work very hard not to defend Iran or any other country, or to act another country. We try to defend our national interest, that to prevent any source of tension or isolation or sanction. So this is the background. That no war did not occur one day in 1 hour. In order to keep Iran on ground, on negotiation ground, we had to vote no in order to keep that negotiation continuing. Because Iran declared that if Turkey and Brazil also abstained or yes, then it means the end of TRR deal, it means the end of negotiation. Therefore, we continue to work very hard. And 15th of July this year, Iran in Istanbul, Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs declared that they are ready to freeze, to stop enrichment if Tehran agreement is being implemented. So these are all process, part of the process. Even still now, today, in the last 2-3 months, Turkey has been working very hard together with our allies, P5+1, and our neighbor Iran, in order to restart the talks. And we will continue to work very hard. So nobody can blame because of just one incident. This is a long process we need to understand. About Israel, same thing. If somebody reads a critic from Prime Minister Erdogan or from me regarding Israeli policies and just take that picture and say Turkish authorities are attacking Israel, okay, did it happen? And again, the same terminology is coming. Pro-Islamic government in Ankara is attacking because they are allied with Iran against Israel. If this was true, why in 2008 Turkey was mediating between Syria and Israel? Why Prime Minister Olmert, 4 days before the attack against Gaza, stayed in Prime Minister Erdogan's house, room, 6 hours? 6 hours. There is only one person who stayed in Prime Minister Erdogan's house 6 hours. It is Prime Minister Olmert. Just to make fifth round of talks by phone. And I was translating, I was carrying the message between President Bashar Assad and Olmert in another room through Prime Minister Erdogan. Why did we work? If we had this intention to be against Israel, or just to attack, why did we work so hard? Again, make a process analysis. Yes, we were upset, we were angry, because that Monday, the direct talks would have started. We agreed, we solved. There only one word was missing to be agreed. Saturday, when there was a planned telephone conversation between Prime Minister Olmert and Prime Minister Erdogan, 11 o'clock, they, in order to finalize and just to specify the venue to start direct talks, 10:30 Israel attacked Gaza. Who is supposed to be blamed? Again, afterwards, they, against all the civilized protocols and manners, code of conduct, they insulted our ambassador. Despite of this, we tried to restore the relations, but the most shocking event came when Israel attacked and killed 8 Turkish, 1 American civilian in Eastern Mediterranean, in international waters. Although these convoys did not violate Israeli territories, did not harm any Israeli interest, they killed these people. That's the first time Turkish citizens were killed by a regular army of another country. Throughout the history, nobody can say that Turkey had an anti-Semitic background. No. Again, looking at the process analysis, Turkish history is so clean regarding to relations with Jews, the Jewish people. There are 4 categories of nations regarding to this issue. Some countries who oppressed Jews in the history, ghettos, genocide. Some countries, second, had war against Israel after the establishment of Israel. Some countries didn't have such a close relation with them. But there is only one country didn't have any history of oppression, just the opposite, became safe haven for all Jews throughout the history, and didn't make any war against Israel as a state. It is Turkey. And close relation. And Israel is alienated itself from such a country through these policies. Therefore, it should be understood properly. And if there was no attack that 31st of May, 1st of June, we would have a meeting, an appointment here with Prime Minister Netanyahu to discuss what could be the next stage of Syrian-Israeli talks. But we cannot tolerate. Of course, we are working zero pawns with neighbors, with all these ideas. We want to have political stability in the Middle East. Of course, the rights of Palestinian people should be respected. We cannot tolerate civilians, women, ladies, children being killed by such attacks using some special weapons. This is unacceptable. We cannot tolerate any country to violate international law, killing innocent civilians in international waters. This should be understood properly. If you look at process analysis, you can realize that this is not a policy against Jewish people or a policy against people of Israel, citizens of Israel, even not with all Israeli governments, but it is, we are criticizing the existing government because of the policies which is not compatible with our vision of regional peace and stability. On Armenia, okay, you can raise, what about the protocols? Again, make a picture on the process. 10 years ago, in Turkey, you wouldn't have an environment to discuss Armenian issue in a free manner. Today we have. Everybody is talking. But you don't have that freedom in France or in some European countries. As a Turkish intellect, you cannot defend your version of history. Again, 5 years ago, there was no protocol which was signed. Today we have this. There is a gradual improvement of our relations, and we are optimistic, we are hopeful that we will improve our relations with Armenia, with Armenians wherever they are, and also we will be able to establish a political order in Caucasia through a peace between Azerbaijan and Armenia. These are compatible. And we are also optimistic, and we will continue to work one day. We will restart Israeli-Syrian indirect talks. We will try to help Middle Eastern peace process. But that should be done only if we see the respect from Israel to the rights of our citizens. And that's the way is clear, apology and compensation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. What we'll do now is to open up to questions. Please wait for the microphone. Identify yourself. And instead of making a statement, please ask a question.
Arsen Kharatsyan from Voice of America's Armenian Service. Just finished with Armenia, let's go with Armenia again.
Okay, go ahead.
You, while your lecture and speech, you manifested the duality of your personality, the identity of academician and politician. So my first question will be to the academician, Davutoglu, and then okay. Second to the politician. You mentioned two important transformations in Ottoman history, Tanzimat and 1912 or 1908 revolution, later republic creation. What was the impact of Armenians on that creation, if at all? Because you didn't talk actually about Armenians of that period. And the second question will be about the protocols. You, as well as President Gül and Premier Erdogan have been constantly mentioning importance of progress in the Minsk group negotiations. And just today, earlier in Bern, President Gül announced that unless there is progress there, there is not going to be a progress in the protocol side. Now, many in Washington, D.C. have been speculating that the protocols will go forward in Turkey after the elections. You, as a politician, do you see that as an obstacle? And will they go forward after the elections? And what do you exactly mean under the progress in the Nagorno-Karabakh issue? Thank you.
Thank you. Again, look at this long transformation. Turks and Armenians lived together 10 centuries, from 10th century until 20th century. Even 21st century now we are together. And if we have a long-term analysis, 9 centuries plus 9.5 centuries, there was no any tension between Armenians and Turks in Anatolia or anywhere. We have all Ottoman archives. If you look at, for example, the tensions between Turkoman tribes in Anatolia were much more frequent than any tension between Turks and Armenians. So, therefore, this is the difference between Jews having genocide in Europe, because Jews were had this oppression because of an original sin, let me say. Being Jew was something, not I don't mean now, but in Europe, in Spain, or in 15th century or later. Therefore, they were oppressed in ghettos, lived in different places, and then genocide. They were not seen like equals. But I had many PhD students. I asked them to study Sharia sigils, they call it, especially about the inheritance. There you can see the most rich people in all the neighbors. In Istanbul, whichever century you can take, whichever neighborhood you can take, in any city, the richest people are either Armenian or Greek. And they didn't have, you don't have any Armenian or Greek quarter isolated from the city. They live together. We live together in all the cities. This is our history. Why did we have problem? It was not because of Armenians, because of Turks. It was the dissolution of Ottoman an imperial structure where people were living, but the new rising sense of belonging was nationalism. And only after 1870s, not even beginning of 19th century, we had these tensions. Even despite of that, Armenians in 1914, 1 year before, there were Armenian ministers in Ottoman government. There were Armenian ambassadors in European capitals. And Armenians in Ottoman archives were called as Kavmi Sadık, which means the loyal nation, which lived together peacefully with Turkish people. Why I am giving these details? If we want to restore Turkish-Armenian relation, what I called, we need to have a just memory. Not memory of a small part of our history, and not only from Armenian or Turkish perspective. We are ready to share our pains. 1915 is a symbolic year for Armenians. Yes. But we need to know 1915 is the year of Gallipoli as well, where only in one front in Çanakkale, 250,000 Turks were killed. And one of them was my grandfather. In Yemen, in Balkans. This is like an organic society was divided. Like you are taking the body out of the context. I don't want to justify any mistake. If there are mistakes, we need to share. We need to discuss and share this. But if you ignore 9 centuries and just focus on a time when there was no political order anywhere in Ottoman territories, then we may face problem. If that is the starting point of our dialogue, then all nations will ask revenge from another nation. I don't want to give, but for example, I mentioned how many hundred thousand Bosnians, Albanians, Turks had to migrate from Balkans, were killed in Balkans. How many Caucasian Turks, Abkhazians, Chechens, Georgians were killed and had to migrate to Anatolia. This is an unfortunate event. Did we remind each other to this painful part of our history, or did we remind the good side? Now, before there was one side that maybe from our side as well, we were denying nothing happened. No, something happened. But something happened to us as well, to all of us. Now it is time to restore. Therefore, we say just memory, ready to discuss everything. Otherwise, all nations will accuse each other genocide. Red Indians here, Mexico for Spain. All there is, unfortunately, there was no zero problem at that time. Now we need to restore, my dear friend. This is our approach. Therefore, we signed protocol with this understanding.
Elections.
I come, I will come. Don't worry. I don't forget anything. I am ready for any challenge. And I signed myself, and I prepared a speech. Unfortunately, later, my counterpart, Mr. Nalbandian, didn't want. We didn't make it. I was referring to this just memory. We want to start a new history. Unfortunately, the Constitution Court of Armenia made an interpretation about these protocols and nullified the content of the Historical Commission. The Historical Commission is important. We don't want to have just two. It was a policy, a strategy of three objectives. Normalize our relations between Turkey and Armenia as two nation states, neighboring. Normalize our relations between Turks and Armenians wherever they are, here in Washington, California, Boston, wherever, Paris, and bringing regional stability in Caucasia. These were three legs of our approach. And all these three should be together. We are still defending protocols. We are not giving up. I never give up. And one day, Turkish-Armenian relation will be having a new paradigm. But I know from our experience between Syria and Israel, we learned in practice, if you don't have regional context of a peace, that peace cannot be sustainable. When Syrian-Israel indirect talks started, 1 week before that, I had meetings with two delegations, and I put just one condition. I said to both that during our negotiations, Gaza and Lebanon must be quiet, because I was knowing very well that if there is a tension in Gaza, that process cannot continue. Or in Lebanon. Lebanon was for Syria, Gaza was for Israel. And although everything was going very well, a crisis in Gaza collapsed all the process between Syria and Israel. Similarly, even if there is a normalization between Turkey and Armenia, if the Armenian occupation in Azerbaijani territories continues, I don't mean only Karabakh, I mean also the other seven regions. And if there is a tension there, next day we had to close that border again. Therefore, what we need to have a comprehensive vision of Caucasian peace. Therefore, we need to have a simultaneous process between Turkey and Armenia and Armenian Azerbaijan so that we can achieve both a regional peace and a full and sustainable normalization between Turkey and Armenia. It is not a matter of election. It is more a matter of intention. Our intention is to achieve both. But if Armenian says we want to normalize our relations with Turkey only, we don't want to normalize our relations with Azerbaijan, and we keep Azeri territories under occupation, that intention cannot be prevailing. Here, I don't question the intention of our Armenian colleague. I know that they also want peace. We hope that one day we will achieve this together. And I am optimistic. You will see we will achieve this together with Armenians and Azeris together. And that will be restoration of our relation as well, which continued 9 centuries without any problem.
What we'll do is to take 2 questions. I know you will have to wrap up because you have another speech, so we'll have to finish basically in 10 to 15 minutes maximum. So 2 more questions. One there. And then there.
So for Minister, it's a privilege to listen to you here. Thanks so much for your presentation. In your speech,
could you identify yourself, please?
Sorry, İlhan Tanı for Hürriyet Daily News and Vatan.
Greek Daily News.
Hürriyet Daily News.
Hürriyet Daily News.
Yes.
I was explaining a question from Greek. Yes, okay.
Sir, you talk about restoration process, different restorations in your speech. And you talk that tradition of democracy actually goes back to early decades of 19th century. And also, as a final restoration process, you talk about the last decade when your administration started to rule Turkey. economic and political component or development of the latest restoration is obvious, made Turkey much more democratic than before. And most of the areas, Turkey became, first of all, start accession talks with the EU, and thanks to your administration for that. My question is, there is one area that Turkey seems that its ranks decreased sharply in the freedom of press. When your administration started, Turkey was 99th place, and now it's 138 out of 175 countries. My question is, why this freedom of press is a problem that cannot be solved in Turkey? Or could you please elaborate on that, why we just cannot catch up with the Western countries in this perspective?
And we'll take one more question over there.
Together.
Yes.
Bedir Mehmetli with U.S. Azeris Network. I have a very quick question. Mr. Davutoğlu, how concerned are you with the most recent transfer of uranium from Armenia to be sold to Al-Qaeda representative? I'm not sure if you heard about the very recent arrest that was made in Georgia, in capital Tbilisi. The Armenian citizens were trying to sell uranium to undercover Georgian special agent, but they were discovered later.
To which special agent?
Georgian special.
Georgian
special officer. Mm-hmm. No, it was everywhere in more, you know, all on news. So they were trying to sell uranium. It was exported from Armenia to was designed to be sold to Al-Qaeda representative, but that was an undercover Georgian special officer.
Okay.
So are you concerned about this news?
About freedom of press. Freedom of press is one of the basic character of any modern democratic society. And if we need to do more, we need to say that we need this more. And there is no perfectibility in the process of democratization. There is always some room for improvement. But at the same time, many of these press freedom of press issues are two-sided, and the press also needs to improve the standards of media ethics. Both, we need both, and we have to be open-minded to discuss this. If we have a question of media ethics or a question of freedom of press, this will deteriorate the situation in both sides. A decline in freedom of press will deteriorate the situation of media ethics and vice versa. We are ready to discuss, but if you look at the in last 8 years, we made several reforms in freedom of press. The press law, I think it was in 2004, has enlarged the freedom of expression. And you can take any critical issue. In those statistics, there are different criteria. But in your daily practice in Hurriyet or in academic life, today you cannot compare the situation with 10 years ago. There is no taboo anymore. There is a huge discussion on many very sensitive issues. But it depends how you deal with these. I can give you now tens of examples how we faced the problems of media ethics. I don't want to mention, but there are many. We are a dynamic society, and we have many challenges. Freedom of press and media ethics are two important challenges at the same time, and we need to deal with both. If there is more established media ethics, there will be less discussion on and less restrictions. I don't try to justify any restriction, but the reactions and the discussions on media, even in foreign policy issues, it is surprising. For example, recently there was a press report regarding a statement of Iraqi president, President Talabani, which created some problems in foreign policy between Turkey and Iraq. It was taken to the press as a headline in one very respected Turkish newspaper. After a few days, President Talabani made a statement saying that this is not correct. It was not correct quotation of my speech. It was not headline. It was a small note in 20th or 21st page. You see, then you lose respect to the press. And we are facing so many problems regarding that. This is on foreign policy, on individual respect as well. You know, the columnist, the most experienced person in Turkish press, which type of phrase he used for leading Turkish politicians, and he had to resign from your journalist. Then, of course, it creates a tension, a discussion on press. I don't say that this is, we are perfect. There are many things to be done, but there are many things to be done in both fronts. Once we have established code of conduct, we will be having also, once we have established principles of freedom of press, we will have a much better situation than today. We need to work together. I don't say we don't have any problem, but we have to understand the source of the problem as well, in all sense. About this, of course, if this happened, I don't have any intelligence report in my hand, and without any such report or verification, it is difficult for us to make any comment. But assume that without any report, just say, in principle, if somebody from country B sells or gives uranium or anything dangerous to a terrorist organization in country C, we think that it is a threat. We don't accept that. But without a verification of these, it is difficult to accuse. But if there is such a verification, of course, we have serious concern. And in Caucasia, especially, we have to be very careful not to create new problems. Okay. Thank you very much.
4 Minister, you are a busy man, and thank you very much for making time for us, the working sense. Thank you very much for a great lecture.